Jason Klom, and this is the Comedy on Vinyl podcast. Hi, everyone. The year, no particular year, the album The Best of George Formby. The artist, as you can guess, George Formby. And my guest is David Melville again. Thank you for being here again.
Hello, Jason. Thanks for having me back.
Of course. So, all right, every time you come on the show, you surprise me with something that I'm not expecting, and I didn't. The name George Formby does not come up that often in conversation with me. So, why George Formby, for one?
Well, you know, a lot of my heroes are people. Well, my big hero as an actor is Peter Sellers. Mm-hmm. And as a musician, my big heroes are the Beatles. And mm-hmm. Formby is kind of a touchstone for both of them.
Sure.
As a kid, you would see him in his movies on TV and stuff. Mm-hmm. And he's just part of the fabric of society, and didn't think too much about him. But then as I grew older, I was doing a production of King Lear in Ludlow Castle in England mm-hmm. about 20 years ago. They're doing the sound check now dance rehearsal for Much Ado About Nothing now in the background. But so I was doing King Lear at Ludlow Castle, and I was working with this guy who was playing Edgar. His name was Mark Greenstreet, and he was this sort of dashing, good-looking young man. Well, not so young, but we'd grown up with him on TV, and mm-hmm. he was sort of ridiculously handsome and talented and sort of a person to be envied. Mm-hmm. And I ended up in a show with him, and the fool had to play the ukulele, and they gave him a banjo ukulele, and you know, he couldn't play. And then it turned out Mark goes, "Oh yeah, you know, I play that a little bit." And it turns out that Mark was this George Formby aficionado, and he recorded the fool's little banjo licks, and I just was fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. And he was showing me this ukulele that he'd bought. You know, he did really well on TV, and it also had an equestrian stud in the States as well. He's a uh-huh. very interesting man, much more intriguing than I ever thought. You know, as this sort of, you know, this blonde modelly type of did.
Sure,
know,
yeah.
These BBC shows. But he'd bought this banjo ukulele from someone, and apparently it had once belonged to George Harrison.
Right.
And previous to that, it had belonged to George Formby. I didn't know that George Harrison played the ukulele. I thought I knew everything about the Beatles.
Mm-hmm.
And I read up a bit more on it, it kind of fascinated me. And in this junk shop in Ludlow, there was an old banjo lele from the 30s, mm-hmm. and Mark and I were kind of eyeing it. And one day, he said, "It's gone. Someone bought it." And I went, "Yeah, that was me." And it really was a piece of crap. And it took me—I had to go to London and buy a banjo bridge, you know, because the ukulele craze, as it is now, didn't exist back then.
Right.
No one played these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I got it set up as best I could on my own and made this sort of horrible sound on it, which to this day has really put Melissa off the sound of ukuleles. Me learning the ukulele is just like fingernails on a chalkboard.
But you do play it in the show a bit.
Now I play it a lot. But this, anyway, just to round up this guy Mark, and he told me he used to do a whole sort of George Formby routine,
uh-huh.
and he was very popular with the Queen Mother.
Really?
Who would invite him round for tea, and he'd play his banjo-lele for her and do all these old George Formby songs. And that really sort of made me re-examine Formby and listen to him again. And he's an amazingly talented person. I mean, he's a brilliant comedian. But on this instrument, he's such a phenomenal player that it's infectious listening to him.
Mm-hmm.
And that combination for me is, you know, something to really aspire to be, you know, proficient in both those areas.
Right.
And, you know, so he, and he, his style is, you know, very much comes out of the world of music hall. And he, you know, he does these songs which are laden with double entendres, and they're sort of, you know, end of the pier kind of humor from the, first part of the 20th century, and but then you'll go into these blinding, you know, syncopated banjo lele riffs,
yeah,
and they're they're phenomenal. And you know, some, there's an English comedian called Frank Skinner who did a documentary about him once, and he said the banjo, the ukulele is a bit like backgammon. It'll, you know, it takes you 20 minutes. Anyone can pick it up in 20 minutes, yeah. But it takes a lifetime to get any good at it.
Sure, yeah.
So, you know, that just sent me on a quest to kind of explore playing the ukulele and just learn a bit more about this guy. And you know, it's sort of, you know, find out more about the world of musical.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I didn't realize, but, you know, there's, it really does come from a kind of Shakespearean tradition in a way. So it, after a while, it slowly started creeping into our shows. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, we find opportunities to have those moments where we can... You know, because Shakespeare's comedians, like sure. Robert Armin and Will Kemp, they were, they're stand-up comics in their own right. And
right.
Certainly Will Kemp would play the tabor and pipe.
Uh-huh.
You know, a little drum and a fife. That he would play and then sing dirty songs, and he could sort of improv in this way for, you know, ad infinitum. And I'm pretty sure that, you know, Shakespeare's plays would have to stop mm-hmm. in order for him to do this.
Right.
So, you know, Much Ado About Nothing Tonight, there's a bit where bring out the banjo lady, and there's a little bit of filthy humor, which, you know, the homeschoolers, you know, will stand up and walk out. But unfortunately, it just goes over the kids' heads.
Yeah, of course, it's perfect. I would have loved that shit as a kid if this had been my first exposure to Shakespeare. My God.
Yeah.
That's one thing, just to give people an idea, because I didn't know, you brought the name up, and he was, at one point, England's biggest comedy movie star.
Mm-hmm.
Or their first comedy movie star in his own right. Like, he... Like, really, and just...
He wasn't just the biggest comedy movie star. He was the biggest box office star in Britain for probably a period of about a decade.
Jesus Christmas. Wow.
Which is... And if you look at a picture of this guy...
Now,
he is not George Clooney.
I
mean, he's got, you know, terrible English teeth, you know, worse than mine, which is saying something. A really goofy smile. I mean,
uh-huh.
he's cute, but he's not...
Yeah.
He's not a... Not a traditionally handsome man.
Right. No. This picture of him alone is fantastic. He's wearing he's got a military outfit on, sort of, but he just looks like... Yeah, he's adorable. Like, he's got the sweetness about him, which I think is...
Well, yeah, and that's very much his shtick is, mm-hmm. you know, in his movies, he, you know, he's from the north of England.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was born in Wigan. I'm not sure. I mean, I should have done some research before I did. But
that is correct. I did look that up.
Oh, really?
I couldn't tell. I was like, because I'm so bad with accents, I'm like, is it Yorkshire? Is it this or that? Because I try and. But then he mentioned Blackpool, and then that at least set me off on a sort of, I got to narrow down a little bit on where the accent was.
Well, it's, you know, he's definitely, you know, his shtick is very much this sort of working class, sweet, you know, guy
mm-hmm.
And most of the movies have a sort of plot where there's an unattainable female, you know, who's, you know, much classier or something like that, and somehow George gets the girl and against all the odds, and you know, he sort of fecklessly works his way through Nazi plots, or, you know, sort of, you know, fiendish people trying to do things, and George,
perfect.
You know, through his, you know, his innocence and purity, which is not without his sort of smutty sense of humor,
uh-huh.
but you know, it's all cheeky and done with a wink, and this sort of, you know, it's in a way a bit like Groucho Marx, like someone who can really penetrate different classes,
mm-hmm. Just through charm alone.
Yeah, you know, and then he'll get out his ukulele and stuff. But he didn't start as a you know, in movies. He really, his father, George Formby Senior, was a huge musical star.
Okay.
whose act revolved around the fact that he had a chronic cough that he could never get rid of.
Oh, my God.
So his act was all about his various ailments and stuff, and his catchphrase was, "Coughing better today."
Oh, my God.
And he did very well for himself,
yeah.
And he didn't want his son to go into... the same business,
of course.
So he forbade him from coming to the theater. So George had never set foot in a theater up until the time his father died.
What?
His father wanted him to be a jockey, and because George was kind of short and skinny, I think he went away to jockey school or whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
and it didn't really work very well for him. But after his father died, he took over his father's act.
I'm leaning on a lamp. Maybe you think I look a tramp, or you may think I'm hanging round to steal a car. But no, I'm not a crook, and if you think that's what I look, I'll tell you why I'm here and what my motives are. I'm leaning on a lamppost at the corner of the street in case a certain little lady comes by. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by. I don't know if she'll get away, she doesn't always get away, but anyhow I know that she'll try. Oh me, oh my, I hope the little lady comes by.
I think he started, he worked up a little act with a dog or something like that. And I think it was when he met his wife, Beryl. And I think it was Beryl that gave him a ukulele and said, see if you can work this into your act.
All right.
And that's how he, you know, he started playing it and then just got obsessed with it. But he invented... I mean, he was doing all the, you know, the standard sort of musical songs and stuff,
yeah.
But he invented this... totally unique style of playing where he incorporated flamenco guitar techniques and added them, you know, to a syncopated rhythm, you know. And back then, you know, the ukulele was a Hawaiian instrument, so they were all Hawaiian songs and but he took it and he made it into this really kind of English sound, but with the sort of, you know, I guess maybe it was later on when it was more the sort of swing. He really invented his own thing, and he invented several styles of playing which are very, very complex and hard to do.
Yeah.
Called there's the fan stroke, there's the shimmy, and the what's the other one? There's a syncopated thing, the split stroke. And they're very hard to learn. I've been trying. I still can't get them down.
Really?
There's a little 16-year-old kid who's actually from Blackburn or somewhere like that. He's on YouTube, and he teaches people how to do this. He's amazing.
Awesome.
So it's still very much a thing, there, especially in the north of England.
Sure. Yeah, well, that's another thing, too, is, like, I don't know that... I'm trying to think of an American vaudeville artist that would match in terms of... you know, of anybody knowing who the hell they are anymore. If there's a kid that young who's doing George Formby, like, that's not a thing. I can't think of anybody here comparatively that would have that kind of impact.
Yeah, there's still a George Formby Society, and they meet mostly in the North, like in Blackpool. They're a George Formby convention, and they trade ukuleles and stuff, and everyone gets up there and they do the window cleaner song or leaning on a lamppost or, you know, any of those. And I've never been able to go to one, but I think that would be really fun.
Well, now that you've pointed these out to me and made me listen to them, I love being exposed to, and that was one of the things that I listened to. I was like, wait a minute, hold on, this is not just a guy doing music hall music. I mean, as much as I might have heard various versions of these same songs before, all of a sudden he does break into, like, holy crap, that guy's playing. Like,
yeah.
Really playing. That really shocked me. I didn't expect to hear that.
And it makes you feel really happy, and, you know, and I get why, you know, George Harrison and the other Beatles as well were really into him.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, they were really kind of witty people as well, so I guess the combination of, you know, being a bit of a comedian and an incredible player. But it was, I think it was Lennon started off playing the ukulele.
That makes sense. I know he loved the ukulele.
Yeah. But George certainly was was really nutty about it. And I think maybe it's probably because, you know, partly because of George Harrison's patronage, that not only Formby is still, you know, people listen to him, but but the ukulele actually sort of
sticks around.
Well, it had this renaissance. It sort of goes, I mean, I think it had an explosion in the 20s, and then people got bored of it. Then back in the 50s, it had another sort of little explosion.
Right.
And then it kind of went dormant until, I suppose, the whatever we call the last decade, the aughts, the zeros, the two, I don't know what to call them.
Yeah, when cute girls got on YouTube and started playing the ukulele. And not only them, but of course it became a thing.
I know. But yeah, but that stuff, I mean, not to denigrate any of that, you know, those lovely doe-eyed girls that sing plaintive songs, and but this is a whole different level of skill playing like George.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it really is about rhythm. And really, I think, personally, as a performer, I find rhythm really interesting, both as an actor and as a musician, because the rhythm of comedy is one of the things that will make people laugh, especially with Shakespeare. You know, the basic rhythms of 1, 2, 3, but the way Shakespeare will write a line that has a very specific syllabic structure that ends in, even if you don't actually quite understand, you find yourself laughing because the rhythmic rhetoric is making you go there. And you know, and that's one of the things in Formby's songs, is that, you know, there's a great rhythm in the writing as well. You know? There's the one, I don't know if you listen to it, Why Don't Women Like Me?
Mm-hmm.
You sing about Napoleon, what is it? Empress Josephine, most attractive woman that has ever been.
Mm-hmm.
Sees Napoleon short and fat, and how can she look? I can't remember it. and then he goes on to Nelson and Lady Hamilton. He's the one with one eye, with one arm gone south, one eye gone west. She screams like the devil, and she grabs the rest. He's just full of that stuff.
I think there's something to be said for also in sort of in the same vein of what you're talking about, is that rhythm, the setup and the punchline and those same rhythms. If you're used to them, I think if you're forced to realize that it's a punchline, it kind of, at least for me, makes me think harder about it.
Right.
And I feel like I do maybe investigate that last piece of information more, and I find the punchline easier.
Well, you know, exactly.
It's a guide.
Yeah, and when something is in rhyming couplets,
mm-hmm.
you know, like those songs and a lot of Shakespeare,
mm-hmm.
the meat is in the rhyme.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's why a lot of modern actors are trained to stay away from the rhyme, because it makes it sound sing-songy or something. Armin Shimerman, who I worked with last year on Discord at the Geffen, he came to see Romeo and Juliet, and he said he'd been reading Romeo and Juliet, and he was asking himself, why is the friar speaking in rhyming couplets, and you know, what's the point in that? And then he came to see the show, and he's like, "Oh, I get it, because it's funny." You know,
okay.
You know, if you hit the rhymes, you know, that's where the punchline is.
Yeah,
you know, it's a very basic form of humor, but
sure.
You know, it works.
Of course, it does, and I mean, it's one of those things too with Shakespeare's, where if people do find it, maybe you know, they do find it maybe unapproachable. I don't think they quite realize how approachable it is if it's done right. I mean, that does take a certain skill to make it approachable.
You know,
I mean, it's one of those things where there are a number. I'm not necessarily embarrassed to say, but you and your company. We should point out that you're the director and the founder of the Independent Shakespeare Company here in LA. We haven't talked about that.
Co-founder with my wife. She's the artistic director. I'm the manager.
If she was
director,
here, I'd say also founder.
She's the boss.
But yeah, I mean, I've seen some Shakespeare plays, you know, I've seen here first, and you know, I'm not a stupid person, but at the very least, I like that I could be inebriated. Not that I'm inebriated when I'm here, and still understand them perfectly well and enjoy them. And I think we talked about last time. You even made Hamlet funny. And that was what was so astounding to me. I'm like, oh, good, this is approachable for me. Because if it's funny, then I can get a handle on it. Because I'm a child.
Well, I think he's absolutely doing that on purpose. And Chekhov really picked up on that as well. Is that if you can get people laughing, you get their attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can hit them with... I mean, Romeo and Juliet was, I think, a really good example of that. Because the first half really does play like a balls-out comedy.
Absolutely, yeah.
And then, it right towards the end of that, suddenly gets serious when Mercutio is killed. And then the second half's got a very different tone altogether.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think it's hard to rein in the comedy once you've let the audience go there. But I think we managed it with that production. And so Act 5, you could hear a pin drop at the end. It was great. Yeah. I think, you know, really a lot of the credit goes to the two performers we had doing Romeo and Juliet.
Oh, they're fantastic. Yeah. They're fantastic. That's what you're doing it again, right? You are.
Yeah, we're bringing it back for three special performances.
That's great.
We're extending.
That's so good. Let me pull up the track listing. I managed to get a hold of it. I want to see if there's some... You know, the other thing, real quick, too, and I try to be sensitive to this stuff, you know, with my modern audience, is that the fear is, how many racially insensitive songs am I going to hear? I only heard one that's only slightly, and it's only slightly. And is that's the Chinese Laundry
Chinese,
Blues.
Chinese Laundry Blues.
There might be one or two jokes. I might have missed a couple. Maybe I missed it. But that's the only one that's really all that racially
insensitive. Well, it was a different era.
Of course
I mean,
was.
not to apologize for
no,
it.
No, but he's also, to explain it.
He's writing about actual... the world that he lived in.
Of course,
where
yeah.
in Limehouse there were lots of Chinese laundries.
Yeah. But I don't think it's all that racially insensitive unless I missed a joke. If I missed some crappy
No, I don't
joke.
Think that he's not a mean-spirited
yeah,
person.
Yeah, it doesn't strike me that way.
And I think that's one of the things that's really just so delightful about him is there's mm-hmm. nothing cynical about his comedy at
right.
all. One of the things I love about Eddie Izzard, actually, is that
yes.
you know Eddie Izzard is genius, but there's no cynicism at all
yeah.
in his comedy.
Yeah.
You know, maybe there's some self-deprecation, but he's
of
never
course.
Mean about anybody else.
No.
And so, yeah, Chinese Laundry Blues, Mr. Wu, what can I do? I've got those kind of Chinese Laundry Blues.
It's more of a sensitive story. It's just about this guy losing his business. He's no longer got a Chinese laundry. He's got to be a window washer, which, by the way...
Oh, that's the sequel.
Oh, is that the sequel?
No, the first
oh,
the
okay,
Chinese Laundry
okay.
Blues was...
oh, that's right.
It was
okay.
one of his first big hits.
Was a laundry man in a shop with an old green door. He'd iron all day your linen away. He really makes me sore. He's lost his hat to a Chinese girl and his laundry's all gone wrong. All day he'll flirt, scorch your shirt. That's why I'm singing this song. Oh, Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues. This funny feeling keeps round me stealing. Oh, won't you throw your sweetheart overdue? My vest so short that it won't fit my little brother, and my new Sunday shirt has got a perforated rudder. Mr. Wu, what shall I do? I'm feeling kind of Limehouse Chinese laundry blues.
You know what? That one I might not have heard. It might not have come up. Cause
oh, right. Yeah, yeah, one. Maybe.
So I heard the second one.
Well, he's the... He's got an eye for the ladies, and he's fallen in love with someone, and mm-hmm. it means that he can't give his attention to starching collars and stuff. So, whenever George gets his stuff, it's not properly
okay.
ironed or something.
Okay.
I think that's
yeah.
the basic premise
yeah.
of the
okay, that makes
of the
sense.
Song. But it's
yeah.
it's really catchy, and it's got a great sort of syncopated rhythm. And my grandfather used to have a dog called Mr. Wu, named after that song.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
Where did you first hear George Formby then? I think we went over why when you started getting obsessed, but like, is it from childhood?
Oh, everyone grew up with him.
Okay.
You know, because in the 70s, growing up, there were only two channels at one point.
Sure.
And, you know, eventually we got BBC, there was BBC and ITV and then BBC Two. And then
oh, okay.
somewhere in the 80s we got Channel 4. I was like, my God, there's four channels. So you were stuck with whatever they were
yeah.
showing, and most often it would be darts or bowling.
Did they figure most of the TVs were on in pubs? Is that what they figured?
I don't know.
That's insane.
Maybe it's the cheapest thing. It'd be mm-hmm. darts, you know. There's this guy with a pint of beer and a massive beer belly. Oh, yeah. Oh, 180. And, you know, you'd be obsessively watching this. And then the movie would come on, and there were always, you know, there would be cheap movies from 30 or 40 years ago. So
yeah.
they were playing those George Formby films
yeah.
and Carry On films and stuff like that.
Right, right, right.
And they were always popular, so, you know, you'd see them in the middle of the day or something. So
mm-hmm.
everyone, I guess, was familiar with who he was.
Sure.
And the window cleaner song... would still be played on the radio and stuff. I mean, not so many of his other hits.
Sure, sure, sure.
So, yeah, I mean, he's just part of growing up and being British, you know?
Of course, yeah. I'm just shocked, though, that in my crazy collecting, that I've gone through so many, just tons and tons of records that I've never come across one. The name was familiar, but that was about it. And it's very strange that it permeates the culture so hard and that yet it's never crossed over. I mean,
yeah,
sure
yeah, no, he wasn't a star in America at all. I mean, and you know, there wasn't that kind of crossover back then.
Yeah.
Some English actors would come to Hollywood and make it, but it didn't. America was not looking at England for its indigenous entertainment.
Sure.
Until really, the Beatles, I think, you know, they didn't really expect to make it in America. They just had to, you know, get on a tour with Chuck Berry or something like that.
Right.
And I think they were kind of amazed at how, you know, I think the world really changed then because the countries kind of existed in sort of isolated bubbles in a way with their own. Although, of course, we were absorbing American culture more and more, especially after the Second World War.
Sure, but I mean that's the fascinating thing though is like that's an interesting thing where, you know, it obviously snowballed where one's influencing the other, and then one is, you know, the Beatles. I mean, there's just undeniable that impact, but like that, I mean, what I'm curious about, and I don't know well enough, is where the music hall and the American vaudeville stuff, they all came from a very similar, but just not the same people. It's a very similar thing, though. I mean,
it is the same thing, only on different sides of the Atlantic. I mean, it must have come out of, for if you want a long, boring history, theater history lesson, you know, in Britain in the 18th century, there were really only two licensed theatres that could perform plays. Mm-hmm. And everything else had to do something that included music, mm-hmm. and they couldn't do full productions. So they would offer a mishmash of people doing comic songs, dances, and then they'd do Richard III in an hour with underscoring and Mrs. So-and-so doing her famous dance in the middle or whatever.
Okay.
And because they were offering this sort of smorgasbord entertainment, and it was essentially, had a music sort of underpinning, they could get away with being a theatre. But if they were just doing straight plays and, you know, the great drama of Shakespeare or whatever, that was the monopoly of the Theatre Royal Drury Lane and the Theatre Royal Covent Garden. And later the Haymarket, I think. So out of that, that became more the sort of lower class entertainment.
Sure.
And out of that sprung melodramas, and then the tradition of music halls, which became more specifically just about the funny songs and the comedy routines. And it's really in the 18th century that American theatre sort of started to really take off. So I suppose it was always influenced by England.
Sure.
You know, most of the great travelling companies in America in the 18th and even the 19th century, early 19th century, were from England. It wasn't until the 1840s that you had the first sort of American star.
Right. And then our stars ended up, you know, assassinating the president.
Right, well, there you go. So I must have come out of that. And then, so, you know, George Formby was a definitely from the world of music hall. And I found out sort of later in life that my family are, on my father's side, were all musical performers.
Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, my father played second trumpet in the London Symphony Orchestra for, you know, 20 or 30 years.
Wow.
And so I always thought that his musical background was sort of very sort of highbrow, but actually we're descended from a relative of this famous accordionist called Will Starr, who did a weekly musical show at Big Theatre in Glasgow.
Uh-huh.
He was really famous, and he was sort of, but he played the accordion.
That's
it was like, you know,
amazing.
He was, didn't become a movie star, but, you know, certainly in his circuit, he was like a George Formby or something like that.
Yeah, yeah,
and,
God, that's so good.
And, you know, other members of the family would sing songs and stuff and perform little skits and things.
Mm-hmm.
So
it's so nice to know that, because I've gone back in my own history and it's boring. I wish I had that kind of, like, that you could trace it to that. That's so fascinating. You know, actually, there's one song in here, in the best of, that you sent me a link to. Where are they? Oh, there we go. It explained a Beatles song from the anthology to me, finally, because there's some backwards masking in Free as a Bird, where John Lennon's saying, things turned out nice again, or he says, it turned out nice again. One of the other, the song is, it's turned out nice again. I'm like, now I know. Because he's playing banjo, or banjo-lele, or one of the two, or not banjo, sorry, ukulele. And that's all he said. There's some backward masking. So now I finally get it. So
well, that was George's catchphrase.
Mm-hmm.
He is all turned out nice again.
Oh, and he says that right at the beginning
that's
of the song.
That's a terrible George Formby impersonation. but yeah, it's turned out nice again. That was... say it in all his movies and stuff like that. It's much nicer than his father's. Coughing better today.
Oh my god. That is just so upsetting. It's just so descriptive of that period where I'm alive, so there's my thing. My thing is that I'm still alive. That's amazing. You know, the other thing too that struck me is that his accent creeps through in every song. He doesn't hide it. There's nothing about the way he sings that hides his accent. So it really informs every one of the songs.
Well, that's really interesting. Yeah, I mean, he's definitely got a very pronounced, I guess, Lancashire accent.
Mm-hmm.
And he really sort of places himself as this, you know, working class kid and a working class hero.
Mm-hmm.
And very much about his audience, which would have been working class. But actually, as a young man, he was rather posh.
That's funny.
And because his father was very rich, they lived in a nice house where they had servants and maids, and George was served, you know, tea and cake by a maid in a maid's outfit every day or something. Maybe making that up, but and I think he went to a private school and all this kind of stuff.
That's so funny.
And, but, you know, after his father died, he took over and became George Formby. He's still really... stuck with being this kind of working class guy. Never, you know, always lived in that community. Could have moved down to London and, you know, lived in a fancy house and stuff like that. But he himself, he really actually kind of, you know, he lived in a nice big house somewhere on the outskirts of, I can't remember, maybe it was Wigan that he ended up living in or Blackpool. I can't remember where it was. But, you know, and so I think a lot of his live performance was, you know, centered around Blackpool because that was the big working class holiday resort.
Right. There's one song in here with Blackpool in the name.
Yeah, My Little Stick of Blackpool Rock.
Every year when summer comes round, off to the sea I go. I don't care if I do spend a pound, I'm rather rash, I know. See me dressed like all the sports, in my blazer and a pair of shorts, with me little stick of Blackpool Rock. Along the promenade I stroll. It may be sticky, but I never complain. It's nice to have a nibble at it now and again. Every day, wherever I stray, the kids all round me flock. One afternoon, the band conductor up on this stand somehow lost his baton, it flew out of his hand. So I jumped in his place and then conducted the band with me little stick of Blackpool Rock.
And virtually every song, you know, is like is a synonym for penis.
Mm-hmm.
With my little ukulele in my hand.
My goodness. There's...
Which is very Elizabethan. You know, sometimes when we're working on plays, and it's easier to actually write a book of words in Elizabethan that aren't a synonym for penis. Because, like, in this, there's a really complicated section in this. Beatrice was praising your wit today. She said, I had a mighty great wit. I said, yes, fine little one, or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we're asked, well, like, what does this mean? I said, you know. Instead, whenever you say the word wit, just think penis. And oh, okay, I get it, right.
Easy enough.
I mean, it's so base and vulgar and really above Shakespeare. He should be ashamed of himself.
I mean, to reach people, that's how you get there. And then if you choose to do what Shakespeare did and have some subtext, great. you can listen to this, listen to Formby for subtext all you want. What's fun is, though, I mean, the fun of them are the stories. I mean, they're very simple stories, Some of them are about him being a pervert. I mean, let's just straight up.
Well, the window cleaner, yes.
Yep, 100%. And then the Snapshot album song is also just him mostly being a perv, which is fantastic.
Well, it's a different era, isn't
of course.
It? Yes, he's a window cleaner that likes to, you know. Well, actually, the thing about the window cleaners, he can't help seeing these things.
Yes, no, that's the other thing.
He's actually just doing his job.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the later ones are a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
There's everything has some kind of innuendo and naughtiness, and the ones on the record are cleaned up versions for broadcast. I mean, the stuff that he was doing, you know, in the clubs and stuff, got a lot.
I would imagine,
I'm sure, a lot ruder. I've always wanted to write a George Formby style song where it looks like you're doing double entendres, but then you actually end up saying the word. There was a brilliant sketch on a BBC, I can't remember the name of the show, but it was a sketch show, and it was one of them, they were setting up this thing, you know, when the people are naked and like they pass a baguette or whatever, and it always just right in the right position, and so you never actually see anything. They did the setup with the nudist having a picnic, and, you know, the pot of mayonnaise was always, you know, she's holding up two cantaloupes in front of her breast or whatever. But then every once in a while, the camera would just sort of veer off, and you'd see a penis or a couple of breasts, and like, it was just...
God, that's perfect.
It was very funny. So it would be quite complicated to do it, especially today when people are not so familiar with the genre.
Sure.
But I was always toyed around with that idea.
What is there about this, admittedly, I mean, out of your range date-wise, what is it about it that keeps you... I mean, you must want to keep listening. What is it about it that's so attractive to you? That's so, like, it's very simple. And they're all, like, a lot of these are tunes you've heard a million times if you've listened to old-timey music. But what is it that keeps you listening?
You know, I think it's, like I said, it's all uncynical. And it's happy, bubbly, joyful music. Mm-hmm. So having it on in the background and stuff. We used it as background and interstitial music for Merry Wives of Windsor.
Okay.
In 2011, and you know, we have a lot of Latino actors in the company, especially in that show. I'd go backstage and everyone would be speaking Spanish, which is just fantastic. You know, it's like, this is a Shakespeare company, this is a modern Shakespeare company in LA. They all got into the music. I hear people humming George Formby, the Latinos humming George Formby, which I thought was just brilliant.
That's awesome.
It's upbeat and it's buoyant. Some of it's very clever, and you know, I love the style. And it's Javi doing his pre-show announcement. I've been playing the uke now for a while. It wasn't really until we did Comedy of Errors when I got really serious about it, because Melissa wanted... I was playing Dr. Pinch, who only has 6 lines in the show.
Yeah.
And Melissa wanted me to do the music for the show, because I've been writing the music for the shows for a while.
Okay.
And she said, write something sort of 40s style, only make it seem kind of Italian, and just don't use a ukulele. And I was like, well, that's really baffling, you know... Because I would write little simple songs for the guitar or the ukulele that someone or myself could play, and they were normally just 3 chords or whatever. And I was like, oh God, what am I going to do? And I had nothing. I remember driving to the first day of rehearsal, and I had absolutely nothing to bring. And she said, you know, can you do some kind of musical presentation of what the music's going to be like? And I went, I do not know. And I was listening to my iPod in the car, and these tunes came up from... this band called the Moonlighters back in New York that I used to listen to a little bit before, when we used to live in New York, and I bought their CDs, and you know, they played weddings and stuff like that, and they're not a chart topping band or anything,
sure.
But the songwriter, the person that, you know, is the, you know, genius behind it, is this lady called Bliss Blood, who used to play in a punk band called the Pain Teens in the 90s, and she's part of that sort of Austin circuit, and you know, has slight sort of fame back then, but now she's writing all these sort of Tin Pan Alley style songs.
Awesome.
with the ukulele. And they're mostly female in the band, and they would play ukuleles and baritone ukuleles, and someone plays a slide, and they do a lot of Hawaiian stuff.
Wow,
and
okay.
And then these kind of Tin Pan Alley songs, and I was listening to that. And, well, actually, that's sort of a really different sound, and it would really fit the bubbliness of the play. And I know there are ukuleles in it, but
right.
It's different. It's not like, you know, we're just playing C, G, and F. I mean, it's like, yeah, it's actually the complicated jazz chords and stuff, so... I said, Melissa, this is what I want to do with the music, and she said, okay, well, can you play that kind of stuff? And I went, I don't know. And I called Bliss in New York. I didn't know her, but I became her Facebook friend and asked her if we could use the songs, and you know, she was really nice and let us do it.
That's
and
awesome.
So then I learned this completely different style, which has... The great thing about the ukulele is you can play all these really wacky jazz chords
uh-huh.
that are very complicated on the guitar, but there's only four strings
on the uke,
so you know, sometimes it's like there's no fingering at all. You just play it open,
like,
I don't remember the name of that chord, but you know, the uke's really made for diminished and augmented chords and all those things that you find in swing music, and so we put together this little band, and Mary and Ashley did the vocals, and they had these kind of tight harmonies, so there's this mm-hmm. little Andrew's Sisters thing.
Yes, oh, it was good.
And then we just carried on playing after that. I mean, it really worked in the show, and then people asked us to play birthday parties and whatever.
So awesome.
And Dr. Pinch only has 6 lines in the show.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, Melissa said, why don't you make him, because it's after the war, why don't you make him... a Nazi who's hiding out.
So
I was doing a German accent. I wasn't thinking too much about it, and then I started thinking. I know somebody, a reviewer called. He said, "I know you're doing German accent. Could you tell me there's more backstory in this character than I've ever seen you do before?" And
and
I was one of those email interviews, and I think I'd had a glass or two of wine, and I said, "Yes. Well, the thing is that Dr. Pinscher." May or may not have been a Gestapo torturer who's evading the Nuremberg war trials, and he's chosen the swing combo as his.
Jesus!
So he printed all this stuff.
Of course,
and I was really tickled by it, you know, because the idea of having a lovable Gestapo torturer is, uh-huh. you know, that's a comedy vein that really hasn't been mined yet. So it was towards the end of the run, and I was thinking about this backstory thing, which really hadn't been in my mind at all. I was just trying to learn these complicated chords. But then one night we came out, and there's like 2,000 people here, and I was like, wow. I had to do the pre-show announcement, and I came out and said, oh my gosh, there are so many people here. There are more people than there were at Nuremberg. I was never at Nuremberg. I'm told that all the Jews in the audience laughed.
Oh, good. That's good.
Because they got the references. A lot of other people were like, oh my God. And Melissa's backstage going, no, he didn't say that.
Shit.
But it was... that character then sort of grew. And then now we started doing these vaudeville shows.
Mm-hmm.
And mostly late night, where mm-hmm. I can do that kind of off-color. Humor, and you know the character's really evolved, so now he's deeply kinky as well as being and he was never a member of the Nazi party. It was just happened by accident. He was kind of like there's a reason for everything,
of course.
And we play these really sort of upbeat songs,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so I've tried to incorporate some of, you know, Formby's playing style into that, you know, as we go along. So that's really been an influence. So to be able to develop a kind of vaudeville type character
mm-hmm.
for the modern era,
you
know, that really was influenced in part by Formby and a lot by Peter Sellers.
Everybody's got a crazy notion of their own. Some like to mix up with the crowd, some like to be alone. It's no one else's business, as far as I can see. But every time that I go out, the people stare at me with my little ukulele in my hand. Of course, the people do not understand.
don't you be a scout? Why don't you read a book? But I get lots more pleasure when I'm playing with me you. Of course I take no notice, you can tell. For mother's sound advice will always stand. She said, my boy, do what I say, and you'll never go astray if you keep your ukulele in your hand. Yes, son, keep your ukulele in your hand. While walking down the prom last night, as peaceful as can be, when some young girl said, what about a stroll down by the sea? She said her name was Jane and that she'd just come for the day. She looked so young and harmless that I couldn't turn away. So with me little ukulele in me hand.
And that's, I mean, who knows where that's going to end. We're writing a screenplay at the moment. There's a producer that's really interested in a Dr. Pinch movie.
Awesome. And, I love it.
And, you know, the Christmas show every year is really fun. And it really is like an old-fashioned musical setup. You know, we have singing acts and dancing acts, and then the band sort of hold everything together. And then, you know, I'll just come up with the stuff. And I don't know what happens. Something just happens, and sometimes I can just riff for 5 minutes on, you know, with people in the audience and stuff, is because I've, you know, I'm becoming this persona.
Sounds like the perfect audience for your song where you just lose the double entendres entirely.
That
needs to happen. That's fantastic.
Yeah, I don't do a whole lot of singing. The girls sound a lot better than me, but it's, you know, I do sort of, I play the ukulele, and I do a funny dance where I sort of goose step up and down, and it's, some people find it offensive. A lot of Germans really like it though, actually.
Yeah.
And it really is, it's, George Formby was really part of the war effort in a way that he traveled around and entertained the troops.
Sure.
And he really dedicated a lot of time to that, and he wouldn't have been much good as a soldier, but he certainly is as a morale booster.
Yeah.
So he's really kind of associated with the war, and some of the songs on that record, like The Long and the Short and the Tall, and Our Sergeant Major, and things like that, they're all...
There are quite a few of those war songs, military songs.
So...
And very positive. Again, there's nothing remotely cynical about any of these. I mean, I'm looking through this list of them, too. The worst they are is pervy, and they're really funny. They're really funny.
One of the sweetest things that I read about him, and something that I think, I don't know if I'd ever get around to it, but this would be a really good one- or two-person show, is that after the war, he traveled around a bit, and he did a tour, I think, maybe in the 50s or early 60s. It was like the 50s, I think. Exactly. To South Africa.
Uh-huh.
And he was so upset that the audiences were segregated that he refused to play for white people and would only do the gigs for black people.
That's awesome.
And
love it.
Became this, you know, was a major kind of sort of political hot potato.
Yeah.
And the government were threatening to assassinate him.
Jesus.
And he eventually was like sort of, you know, chased out of the country in fear of his life. And he was not a complicated man at all. And I don't think that he really was ever sort of politically active.
Yeah.
But I think he knew, you know, had a really sort of instinctive idea about what was right and wrong. And he had no idea that this country was like that when he went there.
Right.
And, you know, just took a completely instinctive stance that was, you know, obviously terrible for his business.
That's one of those things you don't think about in art. There are a lot of people who become purists about art, and they're like, well, if you're not doing your art to make a point, what are you doing? Well, some people find that point in the middle of doing it. Or they're just trying to do the right thing while they're entertaining.
Yeah.
You know, that's very pure, and that's awesome to hear about. God, that's fascinating.
Yeah, I'd love to read more about it. I mean, someone should write a book about that. I mean,
Well, I think, I mean, actually, from what I read too earlier, is that, I mean, well, since I'm not in the UK right now, I don't have access to it. What did they say? One of the first things I read in here, what did it say? Is like, he's been the subject. Okay, since his death, he's been the subject of 5 biographies. So there are 5 books we can find on him.
Wow.
And now I want to read it. 2 television specials and 2 works of public sculpture, which I think is. I
want to
see a Formby sculpture. Very specifically, they mentioned the Beatles here. And I was. I love this. Wait, how old is he in this? Well, if it's during the Second World War, he was born in 1904. So what blows me away is this man's about my age right there.
Right, yes.
Holy crap. That's a rough era. This is a rough time.
Well,
I like his hat.
There wasn't a whole lot of obesity back then.
Sure.
I mean, they lived on a very meager diet.
Sure.
And
They got used to. Apparently, one of the big things. This is just a side note. Got used to fake eggs, and that was they preferred them over real ones at some point.
They got so used to them during the war.
Yes. Yes, and if you've ever seen them, I saw there was a special on the BBC where they're like pink. They don't look appetizing at all. But kids were so used to these gross, sulfury tasting things.
Yeah,
fake eggs, not fake eggs, but dehydrated ones.
It's funny, I don't know if it was like the same in America, but in Britain, growing up in the 70s, mm-hmm. The war was still everywhere, you know.
Yeah.
It was something
that
there were lots of TV shows about it, mm-hmm. you know, our parents would talk about it, our grandparents obviously were really involved in
mm-hmm.
it. And so that vein of humor that, you know, John Cleese, you know, the Fawlty Tower episode.
Of course, yeah.
Don't mention the war. It's still, I think it's probably very different now.
Yeah.
But I grew up with these jokes about the war, and, you know, obviously it's such a, for me, it's just, it's a no-brainer go-to for comedy and jokes. But doing the Dr. Pinch stuff, Melissa's always reminded me that we'd tread a very fine line here, because we have a very different relationship to it in America, where we think about the Second World War, the next thing you think about is the Holocaust.
Yeah.
And that's not at all our relationship in Britain. We think about those bastards who nearly invaded us.
Of course. You think about the Blitz. I mean, that would be the first thing you would think of, and how many relatives everybody lost and sleeping in the subways and all that stuff.
Yeah. I think people in Britain, people, you know, they were very nostalgic for those days, because I think it was something that galvanized people and brought people together. And, you know, for me was one of the, you know, the sort of embodiment of, you know, the war spirit.
Sure. That is the perfect example of what entertainment can do. Not necessarily should do, but can do. Is, you know, it brings people just whatever they need at that moment.
Yeah.
And, yeah, that's pretty good. Do you have a favorite song off of this best of, or maybe another favorite Formby song in general?
One I like to play a lot is Auntie Maggie's Remedy.
Uh-huh.
Is
that one on here? I don't know if that one's on this list. It's not on the list that I found.
Oh, it's not there?
No.
Doesn't matter. The Window Cleaner, obviously. I mean, that's the entry level Formby song.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it's really funny. It's got a great hook and everything.
Yeah.
Chinese Laundry Blues.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. There's a wonderful one called Leaning on a Lamppost, which I think was his first big hit, which really isn't a comedy song. It's just about a guy waiting for his bird.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, those are the obvious ones.
Yeah.
There's the one that's not on there called TT Races, which is really good. I like Madame Moscovich.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of them has like one line that always stands, like swimming with the women.
Oh no. Yep.
I do have a real good time bobbing up and down in the water. It goes right up to my Mason-Dixon line.
Yes, that's right.
It'll be hard to pick
a
favorite.
Yeah.
I mean, when I'm warming up, I play the Window Cleaner a lot.
Yeah.
But
is it simple?
No.
Or no? Not at all? Not at all? No, that's so good.
I still haven't mastered it.
It's a good warm-up then. Yeah, sure, of course, but,
you know,
that's great.
I mean, I can play it, but putting in all the split strokes and
the
shimmies and the... I just really need... And I need a better instrument. I have a banjo...
Mm-hmm.
Ukulele, they make them now. If you go into Guitar Center,
you can get them there?
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't think there's anything to do with Formby.
Mm-hmm.
It's just more the ukulele explosion.
Mm-hmm.
They sound really good.
That's awesome.
And I play one actually on this. There's one song, the composer for this show is called Chris Porter, and he wrote a song called When the World Stands Still, and we recorded a bit of it. They sing it live, but we recorded a bit of it for one of the interstitial things.
Okay.
I play the banjo uke on that.
That's so good.
And it's really fun.
Is it also a four-stringed instrument? Is it just a tinier? How does it...
It's just a ukulele with a banjo pot on it.
Okay.
It's exactly the same instrument.
That's great.
So, but it sounds different, and it does play quite differently. You know, I mean, a lot of people in the company play ukuleles now.
Yeah.
Partly because I've made them at some point. You know, you have to do these songs. You've got to play this. And it's very easy to pick up quickly, and you can write a simple song, and if someone has basic guitar skills, they can learn it in a couple of days.
Yeah.
But then they see my banjolele and they want to play it, and they go, hey, you're not man enough for this.
Normally I ask people, tell us why to listen to George Formby, but you've already done it. We've condensed it. Like, I mean, he was very important to English culture, not just comedy, but English culture. So I think people should give him a listen. I'm glad that you made me listen to him. It was fun. Where can people find you online and the Independent Shakespeare Company?
ISCLA, ISC for Independent Shakespeare Company, LA for Los Angeles, .org, ISCLA.org. We're on Facebook at Indie Shakes, INDYSHAKES. I'm on Facebook at O'Melville. I think you can put your real name on it now, but O'Melville was always going to be a sitcom I was going to write. It always end up with me losing my trousers and the vicar going to O'Melville. And so that's my moniker. No one else uses it. There's lots of Melvilles out there, but no one uses that kind of thing. So that's me on Facebook, and I don't have a fan page.
Are you on Twitter?
I think I am, yeah.
And when's the run over, officially, the final three shows?
We've got two more weeks after this of Much Ado. Mm-hmm. So that ends August 30th, around then. Okay. And then the Labor Day weekend, we're playing Thursday, Friday, mm-hmm. Romeo and Juliet. Sunday, we have a concert with Symphony in the Glen. Mm-hmm. And then, Saturday, we have a concert with Symphony in the Glen. And then Sunday, we're doing the last Romeo and Juliet. And then we're doing some stuff in the fall in our studio space. And somewhere around Christmas, we'll have the Dr. Pinch Christmas Spectacular.
That's great.
Julia. Hot ticket.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you guys for listening. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Jason. It's really fun to talk about this stuff.
It was a lot of fun. And as always, have a good thing.
Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
Turned out nice again, hasn't it? Springtime, summer, autumn, winter, so the seasons go. Sometimes we get them all at once with a little rain or snow. The sun for long, it doesn't shine, it's either wet or else it's fine. Last night I said when I went to bed, it's turned out nice again. In this hotel, I'll sleep well, it's turned out nice again. A sweet young bride then popped inside, turned down the counterpane. She shouted, ooh, I said, peep-boo, it's turned out nice again. Said Mrs. Rouse at Seaview House, it's turned out nice again. The joint is through, but as a stew, it's turned out nice again. A fox she stuck into the duck, it seemed to be in pain. I said, here goes for the parson's nose, it's turned out nice again. Start to be polite. Though it's raining cats and dogs, you say it's a lovely night tonight. With her you start to bill and coo. The glass is falling and she is too. Last washing day I heard them say it's turned out nice again. For the bits of hose and these and those, it's turned out nice again. To Mrs. James, what's her name's, I said you can't complain. It's the same pair, dear, that you wore last year. They've turned out nice again. Said Dr. Wright to me last night, it's turned out nice again. It's plain to tell, the wife's doing well, it's turned out nice again. I said to the nurse, tell me the worst, she said, you will feel vain. This time it's quads, I said, ye gods, it's turned out nice again.
Yeah, I know.